So, welcome everyone. I'm Shelley Macy. You can see the panelists before you, Pam Otis, Robin Sechko, and Maya Coleman. And we'll introduce ourselves a little later. I need to let you know that we are recording this webinar so that it's going to be available to many people who are not on the call today. We have over 400 people who signed on, and most people can't make it right now. So the video recording will be available to them later. So welcome, welcome. My name is Shelley Macy, and I am on the land of the Tlachtamish people up here in Northwest Washington. And I want to honor all of the Native peoples from all over the world whose resources we use for this Zoom call. It's wonderful to be able to do this with you. We know that your time is precious, and in these days, things are strange, and supporting parents and being a parent is very, very challenging. So we really appreciate you taking the time today during your busy life to spend this time with us and put our attention on supporting parents and children in these times when many traumatic things are happening. And things affecting children can be very traumatic. We want to support your work, and we expect today to give you some ideas of about how to help families and some possible additional resources. So I want to whet your appetite. There are over 400 people, I think I said that, who registered for the call. And I'm going to talk a little bit about Hand in Hand before starting on our topic to give a few more people a chance to sign on. So our topic today is children, trauma, and how Hand in Hand parenting can help. Hand in Hand is a nonprofit organization. It's based in California. It started 31 years ago with our founder, Patty Whitler, who has marvelous insights about children and families and many years of real life experience that have that enrich us all. And Hand in Hand brings parents information, tools, and lots of support for the vital work of raising children. Raising children cannot be done well in isolation. It's difficult, and we all need support. And Hand in Hand has a variety of offerings designed to support parents and the professionals who work with them. Hand in Hand has free articles, blogs, discussion groups, podcasts, lots of success stories from parents. So it's not just what the professionals say, but lots of experience that you can really relate to and that professionals can find very useful. Besides the free resources, we offer some courses, classes, and support groups in person when safe, and a lot is online, so they're very available during these times. Intensive trainings for parents and professionals, and consultations for one-on-one support. So the Hand in Hand website, handinhandparenting.org, is a wonderful resource. Excuse me. So I'm just going to go over the four main ideas behind the Hand in Hand approach, and then we'll get on with the topic of the day. So first of all, the first main idea is that parents need and deserve support for the emotional challenge of parenting. We can build that support with one another. Parents can build it with one another and have much more success meeting both their own needs and children's needs. And we professionals can build support with one another. Second point, children are born to feel connected with us, with their parents, with the significant people in their lives. This sense of connection is what they need in order to learn, to build friendships, and to build resilience. When children don't feel connected, that's when their behavior goes off track and they signal us for help. And number four, when we foster laughter and play without tickling, we set limits without harshness, and support children to have good, hearty cries and tantrums. It helps children feel more fully connected to us, to their parents, and helps them leave difficult behavior behind and builds a tremendous amount of confidence in them. So Hand in Hand helps parents strengthen and rebuild the parent-child connection so they can feel successful as they love their children, and so children can thrive on the love parents have for them. And it also has been tremendously helpful for us as professionals and other professionals to feel successful as we support parents and children. So we're just going to give brief introductions of ourselves, and we've got 50 participants on the call. Welcome, everyone. My name, I said, is Shelley Macy. I'm a Cherokee descendant and a retired faculty member from Northwest Indian College, which is a tribally controlled college on the Lummi Nation in Northwest Washington State. There, I taught early childhood education and parenting education for 27 years. Before that, I was a preschool teacher and a child care worker. And in these 40-some years in early childhood education, I was ecstatic to find Hand in Hand. It was the missing piece of all the stuff I taught about curriculum and safety and health and everything else. How do you handle things when everything that's supposed to work doesn't? And it was also extremely useful to me in working with parents and being a real partner with parents. Personally, I'm the mother of 2 adult children, stepmom of 4 adult children, and a grandma of 9 wonderful young people. Okay, Robin, if you'd introduce yourself, and then Pam, and then Maya.
Hi, I'm Robin Sechko, and I live in Northern California in the United States in a town called Santa Rosa. And we have 2 young adults, 25 and 28. And let's see, I'm a licensed marriage family therapist, and I work mainly with parents now. It's really my favorite area. And I lead groups and I'll speak in schools when they're in session. And let's see, when I found Hand in Hand, as Shelley mentioned, I felt like I'd struck gold, and really the tools have enriched every relationship I have in really profound ways. And I used to run a children's summer camp for many, many years and wish I had the tools when I did that. But let's see, I think that's everything. Thanks. Glad to be here.
Pam. Thank you. Thank you, Robin and Shelley. And I'm Pam Otis. I am in southeastern Michigan, although my work here at the hospital is in northwest Ohio. I am located on Potawatomi land. My ancestry is Irish, German, and English. Interesting combinations. And I am a pediatrician. And I also do medical ethics at a very large central city, urban, poor, community-based hospital that's a tertiary care center for the region of Northwest Ohio. I also protect human subjects in research. So my work is varied. My 35 years of pediatrics has filled my life with children and families. In glorious, challenging ways. And I will say that thanks to Hand in Hand, I had skills and a perspective that were able to support moms and dads and children. My husband, actually, before we were married, introduced me to Patty Whippler, or I probably wouldn't have gotten married or had children. It didn't look all that attractive to me, frankly. And I will say that I am still married, probably because of some of the listening skills of Hand in Hand. And we together raised 2 adopted and 1 foster child, and who are successful adults. I mean, it was a surprise to me, I will say. But the Hand in Hand skills have changed my life.
Great. Thanks, Pam. So I'm Maya, and I live in Washington, D.C. with my spouse and our 14-year-old child and our 2 dogs. I'm a clinical child psychologist with a background in special education, and I work with families of young children, primarily birth to 6, with a specialization in trauma and resilience. I'm a certified hand-in-hand instructor, and I'm one of the teachers for our introductory course for professionals, the professionals intensive. I also provide one-on-one phone consultations for parents and professionals. And I do professional development trainings for preschool teachers and administrators. And I also lead Hand in Hand's research team, which is documenting the impact of Hand in Hand as a trauma-informed practice in early childhood educational communities. So I'm really happy there are so many of us on the call today and so many people registered. That's really exciting. So I'll start us off just by talking about what we might be seeing in people's emotions and behaviors these days that may be a response to current stressors or maybe the residue of early experiences that are kind of being reactivated by current challenges. So first I'll say it seems that the understanding kind of the impact of adverse childhood experiences or ACEs, as we call them, is pretty widespread now in the medical field, in mental health field, in the education field. People kind of get that young children can experience toxic stress and trauma, and that this can have a significant impact both physically and emotionally throughout life. But now people are really starting to look at how do we provide trauma-informed care and teaching. So I've been trained in a wide range of trauma treatments and resilience-building approaches, and I find that the hand-in-hand philosophy is very much in alignment with kind of the leading evidence-based trauma treatments. But it brings a different and I think actually more powerful lens through which to view children's emotional functioning and behavior. So first I just wanna kind of illustrate this lens, and I think it might help to think about a really common but kind of relatively small adverse event, but where you can see all of the elements of a person healing from something that has happened. So just think about a child running on the playground. And just kind of imagine they're running around, they run near another child and they trip over that child's foot and they fall and they skin their knee. So we've seen this million times. Think about what is the very first thing they do, even before they start crying or have a response to what's happened. They look around for their person, like their parent, their teacher. They try and make eye contact with that person and activate that relationship. Then ideally that person comes close, and then the child starts to cry. So if that person is able to kind of stay close, pay attention, just reassure the child, you know, I'll keep you safe, just to offer kind of a well-regulated limbic system that the child can connect to while they're crying. Maybe they're trembling and sweating if it was a big bonk or it really scared them. And this is actually how they reset their emergency response system that has gotten triggered off there. There was an adverse event, their system responded to that, and this is actually the process by which they offload the tension connected with that and metabolize the experience. These are innate healing mechanisms that we all have, that we all can tap into when something difficult has happened, where we can metabolize the experience, offload the activation, and then make use of information from that experience. So, you know, they go through this arc of emotion. You know, you'll notice when you arrive close and you're paying attention, the crying may actually increase, and then eventually there's this nice arc and it comes down the other side. And this is where they make use of what happened during that experience. So, oh, okay, next time I'll run around and I'll give that child a little more room so I don't trip over their foot. You know, they've gone through, they've metabolized the experience, and then often they're ready to go back out and play. If this doesn't happen, though, if there's no person, or, you know, their person isn't there, or when they reach out, their person isn't emotionally available, or their person was actually the source of something, of the adverse experience, what we all do and what children do will store that experience. They just sort of pack it into the system and go on, but it leaves a residue, and that experience gets stored in the system, and all parts of it, the sights, the sounds, the smells, and all the feelings that were happening during that experience. So, and next time they're on the playground, that experience gets activated by the sounds of children playing or whatever is happening there. So you might see, instead of running off to play, they cling to their parent's leg, or they're running and another child runs by and brushes them, and their system responds as if that is the threat, and they reach out and they punch that other child. They've gone into the fight flight emotions of that experience, or they're lining up for the slide and they can't really think well enough or feel safe enough to take turns, or, you know, they're building something in the sand pit and it has to be just so, and they get really inflexible, or they just become totally undone if, you know, their structure collapses. And what you can see is that in that experience, it's not actually that much about the current situation, but it's actually about the residue, those emotions of earlier experiences kind of being activated by small things. So children will send signals that let us know that the residue of earlier experiences is kind of running the show. So they withdraw, they become clingy, they're hesitant, kind of curiosity just goes out the window. Or they react with anger or aggression, or they become super inflexible, or they overreact to a small issue. You know, you'll just see changes in a child's ability to kind of regulate emotions and behaviors. It's a lot about regulatory kind of challenges there. And this is actually where the language we often use to help kids navigate these situations really fall short, you know, when we're trying to help them figure out, you know, is this a big issue or is this a small issue? Because actually this, an outsized reaction to a small thing should actually signal us that this is, that the emotional response is actually not about that current issue, or, you know, maybe 5% about that current issue, but much more about feelings from other situations kind of getting activated. So these are the things that you'll see when there's a residue that's getting activated. And I'm sure you're seeing lots of this kind of all over the place with our current stressors. But what is great is that the hand-in-hand tools actually help to recreate kind of that optimal healing sequence I illustrated. So all of our tools kind of strengthen that caregiving relationship. So a child knows they're in your mind, you're keeping an eye out on them, they can activate that support if something happens. So we have a proactive connection building tool it's a one-on-one parent-child playtime that kind of strengthens the child's feeling that their person is keeping track of them and keeping them safe. And then we have a tool for listening to and anchoring children during high emotion while they're offloading the emotional stress and tension and resetting their emergency response system. We have a play-based tool for helping children kind of build back their sense of confidence and competence that can really get dinged when they've had, you know, difficult experiences. And we have a tool that helps parents and teachers set limits on the off-track behaviors that can come along with this, like hitting another child when they come close because it gets misinterpreted as a threat. And finally, we have a tool for setting up this kind of holding environment for adults to get help with their own residue, which we all bring to, you know, to our caregiving roles. So we can then offer this kind of support to the kids we're caring for. So I'll just say a couple of things kind of about the current situation. I think there are some really hopeful things to remember as we're kind of all dealing with really significant stressors. And the first is that we are built to heal from hard things that happen to us. We are made to heal from things. So we have these powerful innate healing mechanisms that are pretty simple things, you know, crying, trembling, talking about things, you know, tantruming. These are all of our reset and healing mechanisms. And we can access those. Children can access those. We can access them in supportive relationships. So parents, teachers, therapists, friends, family, like we can all offer the kinds of support that help us do this healing, even from really, really big stressors. And the other is that Hand in Hand offers some really concrete tools that build these healing relationships, you know, support people in having their emotions, offloading, and through supportive play that rebuilds confidence and competence. And we help adults set limits on the off-track behaviors that come along with this. So the picture is actually pretty hopeful, and Pam is gonna talk about a few of the tools and how you can use them and how you can support parents in using them in this current context.
Ooh, Maya, thank you so much. Thank you. That was beautiful. It's so fun doing this with the three of you. So yes, my focus is on me and us as professionals and our relationship with parents and what it is we can give and do for them. And mostly it's, as Maya described, it's mostly listening. Maya described stay listening with the child, and that's much of what we get to do with parents, because we parents, and I count myself among us, come with a lifetime of residue, of unfelt feelings, uncried tears from our earliest years, and that residue gets triggered for me every now and then, less now than it did 30 years ago when I learned about Hand in Hand, but the residue does remain. It is get riddable though. It is recoverable. It is healable. It does shift. And for me, it's a lot like having a dirty pot in the sink or a cobwebs of clutter and dust over in the corner. To the extent I actually attend to that and drag it out and move it with someone listening, it does go away. It'll reaccumulate if I don't keep after it, but it does go away. And our giving and listening to parents with love, with confidence in them, without reassuring them that everything's okay, because when they're in their time of things in their limbic system offloading, things don't feel okay, and my reassurance is not very believable. So what, we don't have to fix them. As a medical professional, this is, I feel a little bit odd even talking about listening as a physician, because we are notoriously among the worst listeners in the world. I think our listening to a patient has gone from something like 12 seconds down to 4 over the last maybe 20 years of research. So thank you for even listening to me talk about listening. But I have learned that it is the key to a parent's heart. It is the key to building connection with a parent, building trust in a parent, and providing them a space to really look at what is hard, and to appreciate them. No, my first move in the exam room is to appreciate something, anything, that they're there, that their baby is clean, that they have loved and fed this child so beautifully. And so we can celebrate their success together. And then listen to what's on their minds. I can get my job done with, you know, whatever I need to do, but mostly what I'm doing is listening to what matters to them. And certainly I've done this in person for many years, but I also have done it over the phone a lot. And one of my loves is when a parent calls at night, which, you know, we are available 24 hours a day. And I had a mom who called at night, very upset about her baby crying. And so I asked the requisite safety questions. Is the baby safe? You know, eating, pooping, peeing, sleeping, no, body functions are okay, color's okay, breathing okay. So we know that the baby is okay. Now I can listen to this mom about what it's like for her. And she can cry. She cried and cried about how overwhelmed she felt, about she didn't know what to do. And I could listen with confidence and respect and appreciation for how hard she was trying, how much she loved her baby. I said very little, very, very little. And she cried and cried. And then, you know, the crying started to subside, and I congratulated her for sharing, for being so brave, for reaching out for help, that we get to do this together. Parenting is not an alone experience. And then I said, I wonder what your life would be like if you'd had a chance to cry like your baby is having a chance to cry when you were a little girl. And that started, you know, another round of tears for her. And then she sort of giggled and said, yeah, would have been really different. And I could give her the information that it's hard to listen when nobody's ever listened to us, and that what she was doing for her baby was absolutely invaluable in building a connection that she and her baby deserved. And I asked her how she felt about me at that moment. And she was so appreciative and felt so close. And I said, well, and we hardly know each other, and your baby knows and wants that connection with you. And that's what you get to offer. And that's how connected your baby will feel with you when you have a chance to listen, to fully listen. So my confidence in her, my calmness, my genuine caring, I mean, how could I not care about this mom, came through on the telephone. We didn't have access to seeing each other's faces even. And then she was all ready to go off and be with her baby from a completely new perspective. And I can assure you that took, I don't know, 5 to 7 minutes. I didn't time it, but it wasn't an hour and a half. It wasn't a half an hour. It wasn't even 15 minutes. These things don't, sometimes it takes that long. I'm not going to say it never will, but it doesn't always. And if we don't have that much time, I can say at the outset, you know, I only have, you know, our 10-minute window here, but I'd like to hear whatever you can tell me. And it's amazing what people can do with 3 to 5 minutes. So, the listening to parents is a huge gift. And the appreciating of parents is a huge gift. And I can say that I also, access this, as Maya said, that is a place that we as professionals, get to learn to count on one another, that we can't give and give and give this resource of attention that we give all day, every day, without replenishing it. Cars don't run on empty, and neither do human beings. But our sense of connection needs and deserves to be replenished too. So I get listened to in an exchange. So thank you. I think that's my piece, and we go to Shelley.
Oh, Pam, thank you so much. Thank you for describing stay listening, you know, how the mom could stay listening with her baby, and about you listening. I just appreciate all you professionals so much for how much you listen and how vital this is in this time of everything, time of everything. And the listening partnership that you described about you listening with another, like me, Pam and I did a listening partnership over the phone the other day. I was frantic, and she just let me be as frantic as I was and didn't try to fix it. And, you know, after that, I was able to perform that thing I needed to do with great, much more confidence. So the listening partnerships are amazing for all of us and our ability then to be of use to parents and children. Yesterday, I was... I'm going to talk about the tool of special time. And I think this is really, really important in these days when parents are being asked to be their home with their kids. They might be unemployed or they might be working from home, and their children are home for a lot of people around the world. And put in the position of having to somehow monitor all the schoolwork and everything. And I was talking to a kindergarten teacher yesterday, and we were talking about how do we help parents so that they can help their kids? And what I was explaining to her or reminding her about was something we call special time. And that is when, as an adult, you tell a child, I have X number of minutes and I want to do whatever you want to do. And this could be 5 minutes or it could be 30 minutes. But for a lot of stressed parents, it's more in the 5 to 10 minute range. And you say with great love in your heart and your face, I want to do whatever you want to do. And then you set a timer. And this is important because as parents, they're always trying to meet their kids' needs. But the special time needs to be this place where you don't do anything else. One of Patty Whipler's pamphlets, she says, you don't even pick the lint off the carpet when you're down there playing a game. The time is just for the child. You say, I'll do whatever you want to do. And then you do it. And you hang in there and you look at them like they're a brand new little person you've never met before. And you do your darndest to do just what they want. And you resist every urge to explain something or to, you know, ask them, well, what color is that puzzle piece or any of that? It's really you offering them all of you. And it in 5 minutes, you may not think much happens. But then you do it again the next day. Or if you can't do it, then the next day after that. And the child will begin to look forward to it and have ideas for it and be able to really tell that you care as a parent, or that the parent cares if you're teaching them this. The effect is that when children know, like Maya was saying, when they know that they've got, that you are, that the adult has them in their mind and will think about them, then they have so much more capacity for trying that thing they're supposed to do on their iPad with their teacher on Zoom or whatever learning platform they're using. They have so much willingness to try when they know someone really, really cares. Otherwise, they're pretty alone. They aren't, you know, kids, the best part of school for me was recess when I could play with my friends, and that made school tolerable. That's not happening for a lot of kids, or if they're having recess, they're at a distance. So it really matters that they have a deep, deep connection with their parent. And I think that's far more useful and important than trying to explain how to do math, especially if they're doing it different than we did it when I was a kid. Or, you know, trying to be the police on the schoolwork. If the child isn't doing their schoolwork, you may need to set limits, and I'm not going to talk about that, but you setting up special time is really an investment in them being able then to take a deep breath and do the work. And I would love it if Maya would tell the little short story about the special time you did over Zoom with a family so the parent could learn how to do it and give people a picture of that.
Yeah. So actually this is an 8-year-old who is a client of mine who I had been seeing in person. I do a lot of home-based work with parents and children together. So I had worked with this child for a number of years. So now we're doing everything distance, and actually, so I was doing a Zoom session with her, and, you know, she had been dealing with the whole Zoom learning and connecting with a parent by Zoom, a non-resident parent by Zoom. So she's sort of over Zoom. and so, you know, we set up special time, and she actually switched it a little bit where she was asking me what I wanted to do in her special time. And we're always following their lead, but she and I had enough of a relationship that she wanted to switch it. And so, you know, I was sort of imagining all the things that I would, like to do in her special time. And she started sending me emojis, on the screen, you know, cause we weren't being able to do anything in person. She started sending me emojis. Like, so she would send me the cupcake emoji or, you know, and then I would say, oh, I would love to have some sushi, like a good sushi dinner. And like, she would send that over. And then she started to send, like the tornado emoji. And she started to send like all of the like little iffy emojis. And then she started to say, oh, what plague would you like for me to send to you next? And so, and she said, oh, would you like me to send you a herd of horses that will run by you and knock you down? And so it really became that she was visiting on me, like all of these terrible calamities when I was, you know, just wanting a nice restful book to read or, you know, and we were able to actually incorporate some play listening there where I was sort of taking the less powerful role and she was, you know, and I was hoping that something really wonderful would come my way and then she would send me something terrible and I would be distraught and overwhelmed and there was nothing I could do about it because I had no control. She was just sending it through the computer and she was just laughing and laughing like really hard every time she was able to send me some calamity. And you know, we have this kind of relationship, like she knows what's happening there and that I'm sort of taking this less powerful role. So it was just a really interesting experience of, you know, children who have so little control and they have to be in front of the screen paying attention to somebody else. They have no idea, you know, what's coming their way. It's not really what they want to be doing or learning. And you know, in working with children who are having these Zoom experiences, it has been really helpful to help parents set up little special times before and after every time they need to be on Zoom with their peers. So it's a really powerful tool that can be used even now in this context.
Even now, and maybe even especially now. And oftentimes parents will tell me, I do special time all the time. And the key is, and I validate them for, of course you do. And you think of all kinds of great things. And this is just another particular tool. It involves a timer. And the timer is so important because it tells the child, you are in charge and I can't stop it till the timer stops. So it's a change in the power structure so they really know they have you. Well, I want to turn this over now to you, Robin.
Great. Yes.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about play. Play listening is another one of our tools. Some of you probably are familiar with the tools. And I just want to sort of touch back when we talk about trauma, that sort of obviously trauma is along, you know, a whole range. And sometimes it can be one event that happened for a children. Sometimes it can be an ongoing experience, but that children will set up sort of situations to work on things that have left a residue that might feel traumatic or could become traumatic if they don't get expressed. And so play is a wonderful, wonderful tool to use with children to work on those situations. And you know, not a lot seems fun or funny for us right now. When children are struggling, when they're off track, you know, nothing feels light when there are stresses coming in from every direction. And yet, you know, sort of we're here to say and remind each other and ourselves that play is children's language. That's their primary language. And laughter is the surest way to connect with a child. And I don't remember the exact numbers, but I think it was something like a 4-year-old child could laugh 400 times a day, and a 40-year-old could laugh 4 times a day. So let's get those numbers a little more in sync. It's very hard for us to do that. So that's why it's important for us to find enough adult support for all the things we're dealing with in our lives, you know, financial issues, physical concerns, parents that we're taking care of, you know, the horrors of online learning where, you know, I'm thinking about how, you know, I think there's probably going to be studies. I hope there are studies about how maybe mirror neurons aren't activated when it's online and how important that is for that attachment relationship for the learning to happen. So anyway, but if we get more support, then we can move towards play. And, you know, most of us didn't get played with. This is the parents you're working with. That's one of the hardest things to do, to play. You know, sure, I'll play a game, but to actually, the whole thing about play is that it's unscripted and it's in the moment. We don't know what's going to turn up. And our children are incredibly creative about setting up situations of play where they can work exactly at the edge that they need to work. It will surprise the socks off of us, you know, what they want to do. And so, yeah, one morning, my son, it was a typical Saturday morning. Things were completely off. And he wanted to go outside and hit rotten food in our yard with the baseball bat. So that's what we did. We a moldy lemon and an old scone. And then he said, could I do an egg? So I was like, oh, wasting food. Yes, you can do an egg. But he hit it and it splattered all over him. So it wasn't, but anyway, just the whole idea of play. And it's a really worthy journey for us to venture ourselves into play. Because of what can be healed in that way. Because anytime we set up this kind of unscripted back and forth laughter, connected play, that safety of that is healing for children. And for some of us, it's easier to heal some of the upsets that have happened in children's lives with laughter and play than through a big, hairy, you know, 45-minute tantrum. And we don't know what a child's going to need, but when we can move in with play. So, because there can be situations, you know, in a public situation, or maybe we don't have the capacity to stay listen, where play is just the right tool to use, because we can't listen through a long tantrum. And if we can use play to help a child recover, then it's just an alternative. So that's what you want to be thinking of, is what do you have the capacity for? What's the setting? Shall I use play to set the limit, or am I going to do stay listening? So you know, because when children are showing these off-track behaviors, that's when we want to move in. And so what we're doing here is we're dealing with difficult behavior with connection and laughter. And as you interrupt that behavior with a playful limit, out come the giggles. And as you follow that laughter for as long and as far as it will go, and for some kids, it will go a long time. They want to do it over and over and over. You follow it as long as you have capacity and time for, all of that is going to help the child heal. It doesn't have to make sense at all. In fact, you know, the sillier and sometimes the better. And for most of us, this isn't really our go-to pattern, you know, but all these, because, you know, first of all, we weren't played with, but all these messages come up of how we have to teach the child, you know, how we can't, you know, we can't let them know that this is funny or this is okay. But what we want to remember is these aren't the teachable moments here. These are moments for connection. So that your child, once they've signaled you, that the child can feel your warmth and feel your attention and feel your lightness and begin their recovery process. Really using you as an anchor, you know, using you as the regulating presence, sort of to shed those feelings, embarrassment, fear, isolation, worry, so many feelings that children have, because they need dependable outlets, and play is one of the best ones. So they need that safety. They need us to be in good enough shape to provide that safety, to recover from sort of really traumatic moments. And I'm thinking of one example, a family that I know now, what they do is they play Corona tag when things are getting hard. Corona tag. So it's like, okay, Corona tag, you know, you got it. No, you got it. No, you got it. You know, what are the symptoms are going to be? Is that person, you know, I mean, this horrifying pandemic, but people are dying. People are coughing, you know, and then here's my ventilator. All these things that have become part of our daily discourse, right? It's like, okay, Corona tag. There's a moment for play when we're getting really tight. Children are getting worried, you know, and you know, another family, it's sort of like when things get scary, it's like the children is going to, okay, I'm throwing a tear gas bomb right now, you know, and it explodes everywhere, you know. It's like children, even if they witness a moment on television of this, it's horrifying. You lose all sense of safety. So if they can be the one throwing the tear gas bomb, you know, and getting the parent to keel over, you know, then we have a chance to heal from that upset that got in their system, and they aren't necessarily going to talk about it. So again, opportunities for outlets to use the humor, the laughter for things that have really left, you know, a real uneasy, horrible feeling inside. And I do think that the isolation of the online learning, the shelter in place, all of that is, you know, and sitting alone at a computer, I think all of that can be very reminiscent for some children of how alone they feel in the world. And so one thing I've suggested to parents, you know, depending on the age, is to actually offer to sit next to their child out of sight, maybe with the hand on their back or holding hands underneath, so they don't have to be alone in this whole new world that they're navigating here. So the guidelines for play listening is really that you let the child lead, you take the less powerful role, and you just notice what they're presenting to you. You know, children will show you exactly, you know. If I remember, my son used to trap me under blankets, and the longer he could trap me, the more points he would get. And so we don't know what's underneath there, but that's exactly where he needed to work. We notice what brings the laughter, we follow it, and just really making sure that they're leading. Sometimes we might initiate a challenge, sometimes we might follow theirs. It can sort of go back and forth like that. But that's the beauty of play and how important it is, because laughter, it has the potential to reduce stress and to reduce stress hormone levels in all of us, and so we sort of have to go towards it and experiment. If it bombs, that's fine, try something else. And if you get, if you get eye rolling, if you get a snarl, then just keep reaching through that barbed wire for your child. They're in there, and what's happening now creates a lot of isolation around children because they're navigating very new territory. And if they've got sort of trauma in their background already, it's a pretty treacherous path some days. So, and I wanted to mention, some of you are putting questions in the chat. We're going to do our best, I think right now, maybe to answer some of those. And we touched on setting limits. We're not going to go into that a whole lot now, but obviously that's an important tool. Children count on us to keep them safe, our families safe, and to move in when they've stepped over that line. So in fact, when you're playing with a child, and I didn't even mention the beauty of roughhousing, WrestleMania, pillow fights, sock fights, all of that, the importance of that deep touch, the safety in the play that you could be initiating once or twice a day now, if you have the capacity for it. Remembering that in those moments of wrestling and play, that safety will and connection will, it's very possible the compulsion to show you what sits underneath when a child crosses that line for permissible behavior and you need to set a limit, that's likely to happen. And so then the play is changed and you're going to hold the limit. Obviously, in the professionals intensive, we'll go into all of these much, much more. But that's something to remember when you're initiating physical play, is that, that elbow's going to come out, the foot's going to go out. Be ready for that. It doesn't mean that anything has gone amiss. It just means that the safety allowed the child the fear drove the child to get a little bit aggressive, and then we get to stay, listen, set the limit. And so I'll stop there.
Thank you so much, Robin. And one of the things I just want to add about it is one tool that you can use with several children at once. So parents who have several children at home, everybody's laughing and playing, it is a tool that we can use. And I'm so glad you mentioned the professionals intensive, because we do go into all these tools much more fully. And thank you everyone for all the questions. Julie has been answering many with articles she's referred to on the website and other things like that.
There is one that we could address that just came in related to play. And a son who comes home from his dad's and wanting to physically dominate her. And she's gone along with that. But her question is, how does she set up some terms to keep her safe too? And Robin, I thought you might want to just segue into that one. Those of us that are mothers of sons.
Go ahead. I'm looking for the questions here.
I'll address that one. I think that as we do this roughhousing with children, playing physical play with children, that we do learn to anticipate what it is they might do that is liable to inflict injury on us, and we can block those, and we can be physically close to them in ways that make it more difficult for them to get a big swing or a big punch or a big kick, because they don't want to hurt us. They really don't. But what it is, just as Robin described, we're seeing how much they're hurting deep inside and how desperate and scared they feel. So that's a brief answer, but it is about being physically close, because they aren't going to remember limits that we talk about, but we do need to assure them that we won't let them hurt us. So it really is about how we can use our bodies.
And I remember what I did is I would put a big pillow under my shirt in front and a pillow in my shirt in back. I take off my earrings, get my hair in a ponytail, just you know, extra things like that, because like she said, you know, children don't want to hurt us, but when they're full of fears, they don't have the capacity to sort of stop sometimes. And so we're always at the ready. And if the sometimes you can see their face changes and you move right in and you say no, and that's where we're going to set the limit. And again, the play didn't cause that. It allowed them to show us, you know, what your son experiences and what he comes home with. And so you're setting the limit, and you know, it might mean you need a body pillow in there for some safety, a little bit more props, but you're going to stop that as soon as it happens, set that limit, and then you're going to stay listen.
You're going to listen to the upset that is, that was just
right. Bubbling. Yeah.
Well, it is just a couple minutes before we are to end. And so Pam, would you draw us to a close?
Glad to. I'm typing answers to chat questions.
Thank you, Pam.
it's a delight, first of all, being with the three of you. I love you dearly, have such respect for you, and enjoy this opportunity to be together and to share what we know. This is the ultimate experience of getting to share what matters to me most. And I know you all well enough to know that that's true for you. It's like all of you sitting and watching our family video of summer vacation that we aren't having, but and only this is better, because this really is about one life, one child, one family, one community at a time, changing our world to the way it is that we envision it being, which is about cooperation, love, respect, listening, and empowering children and parents to be who it is they in their mind's eye want to be. And we are each leading, teaching a professionals intensive starting in September the 21st. The week of September the 21st, there are various times of those classes. And we have people from all over the world join those classes, which is really wonderful. They are an hour to an hour and a half, depending on how many people are in the class. There's opportunity to learn, to listen, to be listened to, and to make connections with the world of hand in hand, as well as that small group of four, five, six of us that are on the call. And the calls are limited to that number. So we all look forward to meeting more of you in person and in depth for that 8-week professionals intensive experience, where you learn about your own family, certainly first, and then how you want to be using these tools in your professional lives. We look forward to it.
Okay, well, it's 11 o'clock. Check out the Hand in Hand website for additional resources. And I think we're ready to sign off. Thank you all so much for being with us. I love doing this with you three women. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye, everybody.
All the best.